The world-famous Conservation Canine Camp will next be running in southeast Queensland, Australia, from the 21st to the 25th of August. Join us with your dog to start your journey into conservation detection. Visit padfoot.com.au to book your place today. Welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast, the show that celebrates the dog teams protecting the natural world. I'm James Davis, and in this episode I'm joined by Kayoko Johnson and Michelle Reynolds from Conservation Dogs of Hawaii. We talk about training dogs to detect signs of avian botulism in the Hawaiian Islands and try to get the team to spill the beans on some of the other cool projects they're working on. Okay, Conservation Dogs of Hawaii, Kayoko Johnson, Michelle Reynolds, welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem. I'm delighted you guys could join us. So let's get started with a little bit of a background just for people who don't know you guys, don't know what you do and so on. So let's start with you, Kayoko. Can you please give us your backstory and what your role is with Conservation Dogs of Hawaii?
Sure. So I started my dog career as a more pet dog trainer, doing obedience and manners and that type of thing. But I discovered scent work through an organization called National Association of Canine Scent Work. And so I got hooked on scent work. And at the same time, I started working for a local wind farm on Oahu, training some of their conservation dogs. They had just started a habitat conservation program, and they wanted to monitor the fatalities of the endangered species and migratory species there using dogs. At the time, there wasn't much conservation dog use in the islands, so that was kind of one of the first programs at the wind farms over here. So I got to participate in kind of the establishment of that, and then I went on to work there for the next few years, trained a few different dogs and gained some field experience. And then after that, I kind of decided that I wanted to expand my work to not just one job or one application, but different kinds of conservation applications. So around the time I met Michelle and we worked on an avian botulism surveillance program together. And then after that, I established a nonprofit organization because I felt that it was really important to kind of expand the use of these dogs in Hawaiian Islands. There's a lot of different, applications that I think would be helpful over here, but they're not widely used still. So the nonprofit's mission is to kind of facilitate the wider use of these dogs over here, and also to just share more information about conservation dogs to the people in the field, like the conservation managers and such. So that's what we're doing now. And I'm cool. The trainer and instructor for some of the volunteers that work with us.
That's great. Thanks for that. And Michelle, so you're an ecologist. So what do you specialize in? What's your background and what's your role with the organization?
Yeah, so I'm an avian ecologist, and I studied behavioral ecology, and I've worked on Hawaii's endangered species for about 25 years. And as a endangered species biologist and ecologist, we have limited resources. Hawaii has the most endangered species per area on the planet. And there are just so many needs. We don't have the resources. And it became pretty evident that we needed more help. And it also became evident to me that dogs, trained canines, might be able to help with some of our conservation challenges.
So you mentioned, Kayoko, the avian botulism. I've got no idea what that is. So let's talk a little bit about that. Maybe we'll start with you, Michelle, because that was where you guys met, right? So So what angle were you coming at that particular problem from, and what is the problem, Michelle? And then maybe we can hand over to Kyoko to talk about, you know, how the dogs were involved and how, you know, we got them trained up and so on.
Sure. So avian botulism is a disease that affects water birds mostly. And I was studying two of the endangered ducks that occur in the Hawaiian Islands. We've only got two endemic, only found here ducks, and they don't migrate. They don't go anywhere. And one of the things that happened is we were studying their ecology and their foraging and their breeding, but all of a sudden they started hitting the deck. And with avian botulism, they become paralyzed, and so they might drown. Poor things, it's actually food poisoning. And so it's the fat, happy ducks that are likely to succumb to avian botulism. And it's food poisoning. There's a bacteria that produces a neurotoxin. And it's one of the strongest neurotoxins on the planet. That neurotoxin has been studied by the military to see if it could be used as a bioweapon. It's that bad. And so one of the huge challenges is if one duck dies, it can develop avian botulism toxicity after it's dead. And all the little critters, insects, and other invertebrates that feed on that carcass, nothing happens to them, but they will accumulate this toxin and, you know, go off into the wetland and into the vegetation. And the next duck that eats those bugs essentially keels over. And then that one will produce more toxic invertebrates. And so it can spread throughout the food web. And, you know, some estimates are that one avian botulism carcass could cause 100 more. And it just spreads like wildfire. So you have to find the carcasses before they infect the environment. And so the process of the bugs becoming toxic and the avian botulism taking over the carcass can take about 3 days, 3 or 4 days, depending on the environment. And so if you don't find the carcass, you're in big trouble. And so these wildlife managers would send us out to search for carcasses. And I spent hours and hours and hours and hours. And it is not easy, especially if it's fresh, right? But who could smell a fresh, who could find a fresh carcass? It just is natural that to look to canines to help with this problem.
Yeah, great. So that, okay, that gives us a really good sort of background into the problem there. So let's hand over to you, Kyoko, and let's talk about the dog side of it. So, you know, how were you training them? How did you get started? What are the challenges you've got to overcome with that particular project?
Well, this particular project, well, as with many endangered species projects, you know, the permits and, you know, accessing training aids and things like that were not easy, but we made that happen. And I think the biggest challenge was the environment that the dogs had to work in, as well as for the handlers. Hanalei Refuge is a very wet environment. There's a lot of mud. It's also a unique location in that in addition to the regular wetlands, there's taro farms in the water. And so, you know, the farmers don't want their crops being damaged. So we had to kind of work around that and circumnavigate some of the taro units and make sure that the dogs didn't, you know, negatively impact the crops. So in addition to that, there's, you know, hundreds or thousands of endangered birds and stuff flying all over the place. So it's quite a distracting and, you know, stimuli filled environment that the dogs are not really used to, no matter how good they are around birds. So I think getting the dogs used to the environment was probably the biggest challenge. And then also, you know, working with targets that were potentially not accessible to the dogs. So yeah, I would say those were the biggest challenges.
Okay. So from a training perspective, then how were you training the dogs to only, I mean, well, were you training them to only find dead ducks with avian botulism? Were you training them to find all dead ducks, or were they generalizing to ducks?
So the training aids that we used were ducks that had died during the previous year's avian botulism epizootic. So they were stored in a freezer, and most of them were classified as avian botulism ducks. However, any dead duck could develop avian botulism. And so, yes, you're right, the dogs did start to generalize. But when we did our training drills, we used the real deal. And we had to be careful because luckily these were fresh carcasses. But, if one was right on the edge and the invertebrates were starting to notice it, we had to, keep them screened or in a cloth bag or in a Tupperware so that treat them as the hazard that they are, essentially.
I mean, in terms of zoonotic disease transfer and so on, was there any risk to the dogs? So what indication were you shaping, for the dogs? Were they, because in the environment that you talk about, in some respects, a retrieve would probably be, a good option, maybe. Is that what you did? Did you just get the dogs indicating on the carcass? Was there any risk to the dog of zoonotic disease transfer, anything like that?
Yeah, we used a passive alert, mostly a sit, because we definitely did not want them to retrieve the targets. And, they were wearing muzzles anyway for safety, so they probably couldn't retrieve it if they tried. But yeah, we definitely did a passive alert.
Yeah. Okay. And the muzzle safety for the other endangered creatures?
The endangered birds, yes.
Yeah. 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 So just making sure that the dogs didn't become too enthusiastic. And
if the carcass had been there for a while and it had, hundreds and thousands of fly larvae on it, and a dog picked up that and swallowed some of those larvae, they could. It could be detrimental to them as well, right? Mm. If they'd get a dose of neurotoxin, essentially, if they swallowed some of those maggots.
Yeah. So you absolutely don't want that. So which muzzles were you using? Basket muzzles? Did you need something a bit more enclosed? And how does that work in the sort of conditions you work in?
Sure. We actually used a specialized or custom-made half muzzle that came from New Zealand. It's a little bit different from the standard ones, I think, that the New Zealand Department of Conservation uses. It's a lighter gauge wire that's really light, and the dogs adapt to it immediately. We ordered it from Paul Jansen, I think, who also works for the New Zealand Department of Conservation. And so it leaves the nose area exposed so that the dogs can, sniff effectively, basically. But the bottom half of their muzzle is covered, and it's kind of tapered in a way that they can open their mouth fully and pant and drink water and all that kind of stuff. So it doesn't affect, it doesn't cause them to overheat or anything like that.
Hmm. Yeah, that sounds like a good design, because in my experience, that's part of the challenge. If I'm working my dogs over here, which is similar conditions in some respects to Hawaii, at certain times of the year. If I'm using a JAFCO muzzle or something like that in my dogs, I'm having to, to remove it quite frequently because it's just too enclosed. It gets too hot, hard for them to breathe, pant, even though they can drink through it and so on.
Right.
You have to give them a bit of a break from it quite regularly. So that's really interesting and hopefully a helpful tip there for anybody who's experiencing a similar problem is looking for the right tool for the right job. So
yeah, sure, we'd be happy to share the contact info, so let us know.
Awesome. Okay, so let's carry on talking about this particular project. So what results have you had? So how long has the project been going for? How successful has it been? Have you won the hearts and minds of the scientists and the government and the farmers and everything, or is it still an uphill battle?
Hearts and minds were won. Pocketbooks are still a little bit tight, but it was a pilot project, and I think it was hugely successful. We had a really fun double-blind experiment where we had hides placed and we randomly drew whether a human would search or a canine team would search, and the results were encouraging for both canines, who of course did really well and detected most of of the carcasses. But the humans, even though they didn't find as many, the ones that they found were often the carcasses that the dogs missed. And so that was it was really neat to overlay those results and see, you know, sometimes a carcass might be tucked away, you know, in a corner where there's not a lot of airflow, or, you know, it is visually obvious. And so those interesting results were made the volunteers realize that their jobs were still very, very important for managing avian botulism. And so the paper was published in, it's an offshoot of conservation biology called Conservation Science and Practice, if anybody wants to read it. And we shared efficiency information and also efficacy. So traditional searches were done with ATVs and pedestrians, and everyone had, you know, maybe they were more efficient on the ATV, but they might have missed carcasses in dense vegetation. Mm-hmm. Pedestrians actually did a really good job. Yeah. However, they were slower. So yeah. I think the dogs hit both efficacy and efficiency.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really great, because oftentimes you feel, so sometimes as a handler, you feel like a bit of an interested observer to the job, you know, so the dog's kind of really doing all the work. And I've said in previous shows that that sometimes you find yourself sort of scratching yourself, sort of trying to work out how you can actually add value, you know, to the job, you know, apart from obviously keeping your dog safe and so on. But you know, if actually you are finding some good results from the human element as well as the canine element in those searches, then that's it's a glowing testament to the teamwork, isn't it, really? So that yes, that's great. So pilot, obviously, as you said, pocketbooks, you know, are tight, tightly shut. So I mean, do you think it's going to get off the ground? I mean, do you think it's proven itself sufficient to become something that will happen?
Yeah, actually, it is happening right now.
Oh, great.
Starting late last year, we've been helping the refuge develop their volunteer canine program. So I've flown over to Kauai a few times and worked with their, you know, their dog handlers and dogs, and we do weekly Zoom meetings. And yeah, they're currently conducting surveys. So we'll see how it goes. But yeah, I think it's going well so far.
Cool. And how are they getting on? Doing well?
Yeah, they are. You know, after working through initial, you know, training challenges and such, they're doing great right now and very excited to be out there helping the ducks.
Fantastic. That's cool. Okay, so let's move on from ducks. So what are the some of the other key ecological challenges in Hawaii at the moment, and how are dogs helping in that?
Another project we worked on, Hawaii has a lot of problems with invasive species. And, you know, with the islands, you know, the biocontrol is not what it should be. Some of the remote islands have had introduction of really harmful invasive ants. There's a species from Southeast Asia, yellow crazy ant, that made its way to a national wildlife refuge that is set aside for seabirds. And I'll let Kyoko tell you more about the yellow crazy ants. And that was another project that we worked on that was very specific to islands.
Yeah, cool. So, okay, let's talk about those yellow crazy ants. They're a gnarly little bugger, aren't they?
Yeah, and I believe you have them in Australia as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, these ants, they don't sting. They actually spray a toxic acid that can burn the skin. And what was happening at Johnston Atoll was that, you know, they just multiplied so much that they were affecting the seabirds that were nesting there, in particular the chicks that are on the ground. And they can't escape the ants. So that project by U.S. Fish and Wildlife to eradicate these ants started, I think, almost over 10 years ago. And every 6 months, they send a crew out there to know, survey for ants and figure out the best way to bait them and treat them. And I think after about 7 or 8 years, they finally got it to a level where they weren't finding any of these ants. So it was pretty successful, but they wanted to make sure before they left the island, you know, and removed all the teams, that there definitely was not any ants. So that's kind of where the dogs came in. Of course, you know, you can't say for 100% sure that, you know, there's no ants, but the project leader, Aisha, had attended a conservation dog symposium that our organization hosted at the Hawaii Conservation Conference a couple of years ago, where we had invited, you know, guests from all over the world, Taiwan, New Zealand, the mainland, to talk about different conservation projects that they've done with dogs. And so Aisha attended that symposium and saw the red imported fire ant presentation and was inspired to pursue dogs for this project. So I got hired, and then Michelle was a second dog handler on the project. And we went out there last December to do the monitoring, the surveys, and we didn't find any ants. So that was a good thing. Interesting, because you know, we trained on Oahu, and the yellow crazy ants are pretty prevalent over here. So it was not hard to, you know, gather training aids and stuff like that, which, you know, is kind of unusual, because usually it's not that easy to get stuff. So we were lucky in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it's always one of the challenges, as everyone listening knows, you know, is actually getting and storing training aids and so on. So anything where you can actually get a ready supply, even of something nasty, is a good thing. Anything else? Yep.
Kyoko forgot to tell you that it took 3 days by ship to get to this island. We had to put put the dogs on the boat, and they were so polite that they wouldn't go to the bathroom on the deck, and they almost held it for the whole trip until we got there. Yeah, and we had smoothies on the way there, but on the way back, it was so rough that there were waves washing over the deck, and everybody was seasick, the dogs included.
Oh,
so yeah. It was quite the adventure to go sniff for ants.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Next time you'll have to just parachute in or something like that.
That would be easier.
Yeah. A little bit of fun for you there. Cool. So any other species you're working on or looking at or considering or piloting or anything at the moment?
So I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about some of it, but there is.
I'm intrigued now.
Yeah. Maybe in a part two or
next
something.
Next one.
Yeah. But there's two lines fiddle bug. Can I talk about that? Yeah.
Yeah, everyone can hear you whispering.
Okay, so yeah, we were contacted by the University of Hawaii Hilo Agriculture Department because they were looking into using dogs to detect the two-line spittle bug. And that's an insect that harms the pasture land over here on the Big Island. And it's a big industry here, so it would be devastating. I mean, it's already devastating the industry, but if they let it get any worse, you know, it could be extremely harmful to the economy as well as the environment. So that is something that we're talking to them about testing out.
Cool. Cool. I won't get you into any more trouble by inquiring on that further, but yeah, hopefully you can share more details of that with us and anything else. It's all secret squirrel or whatever that you're working on at the moment.
Sure, so. Yeah. But just, you know, in general, there are so many ways that dogs could be used in the Hawaiian Islands. As Michelle mentioned, there are a lot of invasive species problems. And then there's a lot of, you know, endangered species. I think this is the endangered species capital of the world.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, we have a endangered bat here. It's the only endemic mammal, terrestrial mammal, and there's huge challenges of finding their roost. So that's one application I'm really interested in, because such big conservation challenges for these elusive nocturnal species.
Yeah.
That's on my to-do list.
I imagine you've got quite an extensive to-do list of things that we could be using the dogs for quite in a beneficial way. Okay, so let's move on from that then. So let's talk about working in Hawaii. So what particular environmental factors do you have to consider there? So climate, altitude, vegetation, topography, you know, what really impacts your training and your field kind of deployment methods? What do you have to work around?
Well, I think it's really important for the dogs to be well acclimated to the environment where they're working. And we have so many different environments in Hawaii. There's usually a windward side and a leeward side. So a hot, dry part of the island and then a really wet, muddy windward side. Acclimating to that area and conditioning to the area where you're going to work, I think it's the most important thing. We have really rough terrain, for instance, lava as well. Having dogs that are ready to work, acclimated to that habitat is ideal.
Yeah,
and that's one of the things that we're aiming is to build local capacity, because you know I think in the past dog handler teams have been hired from abroad and brought over here, which is great. But you know, in addition to the dogs having a hard time acclimating, it's very expensive, and you know, there's all kinds of rabies vaccine paperwork and fees involved, so it's kind of a hassle. So we're hoping that you know we can expand the local teams and help the conservation people like that.
Yeah, no, cool. So what breeds or types of dogs do you prefer for Hawaiian conditions?
I prefer short-haired, light-colored dogs. I think are ideal for this environment just because it's so hot. I mean, the sun will burn your skin, basically. Me personally, I like the sporting breeds, like you know, retrievers, pointers, spaniels. I find that their you know, high hunt drive just allows them to you know work through all kinds of distractions and you know, weather conditions, and they just have the strong drive to keep working and hunting. So that's what I would like personally. But I mean, we have all kinds of dogs here. Our volunteers have different breeds as well.
So what's coming up next for Conservation Dogs of Hawaii? So you said you've got a bit of a list of things to do. You've got a lot of things you can't talk about. What is next that you can? I've stumped you there, haven't I? Now,
well, we have a variety of projects that are that we've you know proposed and are waiting to hear back from. One of them is actually devilweed, the invasive plant that our volunteer teams are looking for on Oahu. That's already an established program that's going very well. But you know, because each island has its own invasive species challenges. The Big Island actually just recently discovered that they have devilweed as well. It was brought over on, I think, motocross equipment accidentally. So it's not very established here, and they still have a chance to eradicate it. Whereas, you know, on Oahu, it's pretty well established, so it's more of a containment phase. So, you know, we're looking into coming over to the Big Island with some of our dog teams to help the Big Island invasive species group with their efforts. So that's one thing. You know, there's several other things as well that we're working on or actively already training for that we can't talk about. But
no, cool. All right, I'll stop putting you on the spot in that context, and I'll put you on the spot in something else. So okay. So as you may have heard in my recent interview with Laura Holder from the Conservation Dogs Collective, we've got a new segment in the show where I ask theoretical training or field craft questions that may help some of our listeners experiencing similar challenges. So I've got a question for you, which I did give you a heads up about, yeah, because I'm not that mean. Yes. So working for long durations in hot, humid conditions is extremely taxing and can lead to reduced drive on part of both the dog and handler, particularly if you're conducting a hard search without much opportunity to reward finds. So how can you combine training and field handling to motivate a dog to reliably maintain a long search in hot, humid conditions without many winds?
Wow, that was a lot of different aspects to the question.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Michelle mentioned a few of, you know, the things that we do is just acclimating the dogs to the, you know, the weather conditions or the climate that the dog will be working in. So, for example, you know, I don't use AC for my dogs very much. Like, I just have them natural in the, you know, existing conditions so that they get used to that. Obviously, you don't want them to overheat. So we pick days and times that are conducive to, you know, productive searching. But, you know, we also try to train, push them a little bit so that they do get used to, you know, the heat and humidity. As far as, you know, just not having many finds, I think that, you know, it kind of depends on the dog, right? So, like I mentioned, the hired hunt drive dogs earlier, and I found personally that if I work with a dog with extreme, you know, hunt drive, then they're not necessarily working for the finds so much as they love the hunt itself. And so, yeah, it's nice for them to have occasional finds, but they're not, you know, dependent on that. And I think that's very important in the field work that we do, because like you say, there aren't always going to be a lot of finds, or maybe it's not so easy to put out training even. For example, at the Hanalei Wildlife Refuge, you know, just to even walk into the taro farm, which is like mud and water, and put out a carcass hide, it was very challenging. I mean, you could take two steps and sink to your knees. So, I guess just going back to just picking the right dog that is not dependent necessarily on having frequent finds, and then training towards it as well by not having the training be so different from the actual surveys.
You do raise a point which comes straight into the question I asked Laura, actually, which was about when you're working with these high drive, you know, hunting dogs and that sort of thing, the dogs that are motivated more by the job than they are by the reward, how do you get them to hold a reliable indication? If their main reward is they just want to go again, so if that's their primary reinforcer, how are you teaching them to actually hold that indication?
That's a great question. So I'm actually a big fan of the direct rewards system. You know, it's funny because I listen to the Canine Talking Sense a lot, and I know they talk about indirect versus direct a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of the direct system just because, you know, it's immediate payment. It's paying at source, which is not, the purpose is not to trick the dog into thinking the reward is coming from the source. It's more just that, you know, if the reward comes from there, then the dog is just more likely to stick around there. You know, I'll often go walk my dogs at a park and water faucets, and the dogs will always walk to the water faucet, look at me in the communication, and then wait for me to come there and give them water. So they know the water is not coming from me, but I'm the one who's going to turn on the spigot. So to me, like, the direct reward system is sort of like that. And it just conditions them to stay at source, even for the dogs that want to keep moving and keep hunting, just because, boom, the reward shows up right there. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. But this is where all the classical conditioning comes in, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, what you need to do is classically condition your dogs to stay, you know, at that indication until released,
right?
Despite the fact that what they really want to do is just keep going.
Keep hunting. Yeah. And, you know, we don't put a huge focus on the final response. You know, we tend to add it later because, mm-hmm. you know, in fact, most of the time in the field, I feel like the handlers and we can read the dog pretty well. And, you know, you don't necessarily need an indication. I mean, it's nice to have sometimes. And there might also be situations where a final response might be counterproductive. Like, for example, with, you know, the invasive plant that we work with, the source odor seems to not necessarily be as strong as the cooling odor. So, you know, introducing an indication too early, I think, can cause a lot of fringe alerting and frustration and stuff like that.
Yeah. And my fear is always, though, I mean, I don't know how you work with your dogs, but mine are often out of sight of me. And so, you know, I'm worried, you know, that they're going to find something. You know, they may throw an indication, but I'm not going to be there to see it. Or frankly, you know, in the conditions we have here, which are similar to there, I'm just going to be too tired to notice by the end of the day. yeah, which is my own kind of fallibility, you know, and something's going to be missed. And so that's where I think, you know, if there's, and I'm constantly playing with this, you know, to try and find a winning formula, really. You know, but yeah, I think I'm
actually,
getting
that there, reminds me. Yeah. recently, one of our volunteered, you know, invasive plant dog handlers just gave us a field report and said that, you know, the dog went out of sight, didn't come back for a while. And when the dog came back to look for her, the look on the dog's face was different from, you know, I was being naughty and now I'm back. It was more like, you know, hey, you need to come and check this out. Mm. So just knowing the dog so well, she knew that there was something worth investigating, and then the dog brought her back to the target. So I guess that would be a little bit like, you know, some of the search and rescue dogs that do a recall alert. It wasn't necessarily trained, but I think with the dogs and handlers developing really good relationships, you know, that kind of thing can happen as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point there, that yeah, the more familiar you are with your canine companion, your canine teammate, you really can, you know, read their emotions, their state, their expressions, their, you know, their everything, and you do just know, you know. And so yeah, the more time people can get out there with their dogs and actually doing the training, doing the job, you know, everything becomes better and easier as you go through, because, yeah, the more familiar you get. Great. So Kayako, Michelle, thanks very much for taking the time to chat today. Really appreciate you taking the time. So if people are interested in learning more about the work that you guys are doing and following you and looking at all the cool stuff you're doing, so how should they do that?
Sure. We have a website, conservationdogshawaii.org, and we are also on Instagram and Facebook at Conservation Dogs Hawaii. We just started Twitter, but we don't have anything posted there, so that'll be upcoming.
Yeah, I think it's only for Trump, isn't it, Twitter? Okay. Thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much,
good luck.
James.
All right. Thank you.
See ya.
Right, bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Conservation Canine Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share, and subscribe wherever you find us.